This is day two of this December 2012 four-day session. We'll resume reading from our text of yesterday. Which is an anthology of Rinzai Zen. The title of the book is The Original Face, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. We left off yesterday with a short listing of, this is in the section of sayings of Bunan, 17th century Japanese Zen master Bunan. And he was listing things people are always wrong about. And the first was hating to be fooled by others while liking to be fooled by oneself. We covered that. Knowing others die but not realizing one's own death. And then third, discriminating others' right and wrong while not acting properly oneself. Well, this would fall under our precepts number 6 and 7, a resolve not to speak of the faults of others, but to be understanding. A resolve not to speak of the faults of others, but to be understanding and sympathetic, and I resolve not to praise myself and disparage others, but to overcome my own shortcomings. It's always easy to find fault with others, to notice where others are acting wrongly or breaking rules. It's very useful for people on the path to learn when focusing on others' faults, to learn to, first of all, notice it. That's the hard part, is noticing that for the umpteenth time one is finding fault with others. And then once having noticed it, because you can do this all day long without noticing it, once you realize what you're doing, to shine the light of awareness back on oneself and consider whether what you're focusing on in that person or those people isn't something in yourself that you just would rather not see in yourself. This is, I believe, quite a common way of functioning for us human beings is if there's something we don't want to face in ourselves, something that's painful that we would reflect badly on us, we may be able to stay in the dark about it in ourselves, but then we are quick to see it in others and disparage others, either outwardly or just in the mind. The next one is suffering from want and not knowing how to avoid it. Well, in a way, this is the human predicament, is always wanting something more. We call it dukkha, dissatisfaction, frustration. It is our common lot. the human predicament. With the practice, though, we do know how to avoid it. We do know that something can be done about it. I love what children's book illustrator, Maurice Sendak, who wrote Where the Wild Things Are, he had it right, I think, when he said, there must be more to life than having everything. Even if we could manage to accumulate, to acquire everything we could think of that we want, it would still not be enough. There would always still be something more we want. This is our nature. And then even if we could find absolutely everything, we could acquire absolutely everything we would ever dream we wanted, then what's going to happen? Something will change. Something will lose something. Even if we could find the perfect mate and live in the perfect house with a perfect fleet of cars and the perfect neighborhood and have the perfect children and the perfect body and the perfect mental intelligence, still something is going to drop out of that. Gonna get divorced, break up, get injured, get sick, have our children get injured or sick, and so forth. It is not intelligent to spend one's life trying to arrange everything exactly the way we want it. It's much more intelligent to find a way to not be driven by our desires, to even minimize our desires. Then that means simplifying our lives. And simplifying our lives begins with simplifying the mind, quieting the mind. And that's why we're here. We discover through practice that this ceaselessly wanting mind is supported by thoughts. It is sustained by our involvement in our thoughts about what we want, our desires. And when we don't give way to those thoughts, if we don't keep chewing on how we might be happier if we could only da-da-da-da-da, then we find contentment, or more contentment. But maybe everyone here knows that. Everyone here has been practicing long enough, almost everyone, to have learned this, that we don't have to chase after these things that we think we want. Shakespeare knew a lot. He understood a great deal. He said, "The sea hath bounds, but deep desire hath none." When we're in the throes of a passion, a craving, can we have the presence of mind to remember that it will pass? It'll pass. It may last way longer than it's healthy for us to have it last, but it'll eventually pass. But out of habit, out of our deep, deep conditioning, We tend to think it has to be satisfied, this desire. We have to get what we want. But what do we really want? What is it that anyone really wants? We want peace of mind. Peace of mind implies that we're free of our cravings. That's what a major part of peace of mind is, to be free of this baying hound of desire. But beyond that, who wouldn't want to know what we're doing here? The meaning of life. Suffering from want and not knowing how to avoid it. The Buddha laid out his eightfold path: right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. In Zen, it all comes down to being fully present and aware. Noticing the desires as they come up, because they always will, I'm guessing. Noticing the desires, having the presence of mind to see them as temporary states, having the faith that they'll pass. The next one on his list of things is things people are always wrong about is thinking that original nothingness is nothing. Well, this word nothing is such an ambiguous one. It can be understood in different ways, and with a translated text like this, my best guess what he means is that imagining that this state of the primal void, to use the phrase from the Prajnaparamita, that it's just the absence of something, that this nothing stands in contradistinction to everything. And this is a complete misunderstanding of Buddhist no-thingness or emptiness, which is instead is that it is not apart from everything. It's not this cold, remote realm. I always used to picture this primal void as deep space. I usually had some image of an astronaut whose tether to the spacecraft was sundered and was drifting off into the blackness of empty space. But awakening reveals that the astronaut himself is this nothing. And the tether and the spacecraft, it's all nothing. This, nothing. No discrete substantiality to it, that no unchanging thingness to it. As soon as we refer to it, it's already changed. It is change, what we think of as things. We are change. We are flux. There's a simple, famous statement in Zen. From the very beginning, there has never been a single thing. From the very beginning, there has never been a single thing. This is the fundamental insight in the Dharma. And then this is related, the next one is related to that, setting up something in the way of enlightenment, which I take to mean imagining that there is a place and a time apart from here and now that is enlightenment. And that enlightenment is something other than this, now, here. Once we conceive of enlightenment as a thing, then it's almost inevitable that we'll formulate a goal, we'll make it into a goal of getting from here to there. And that's the fundamental delusion, that it's somewhere other than right here. And then we move into what is called Bunan's Regulations for Disciples. And he begins, "A monk is the greatest evil on earth. He goes through the world without labor. He is a great thief." Here, naturally, he's reminding the monks that they have a great, great privilege in not having to devote their lives to working in a worldly sense, and as a result, because of their station, their monastic calling, they have an obligation to live up to the promise, the potential that is offered by this life. He goes on, "When the fruits of discipline and practice are fulfilled, and one may be a teacher of others, he is a precious jewel in the world. There are innumerable teachers of the ways of the world, but teachers of the great way are rare." And then he switches abruptly into this statement, "Do not use unwisely even a piece of paper or half a penny." Probably everyone here knows that that not wasting is a really basic principle of the Zen ethic, not for just to save our resources or save money, but because it shows disrespect. To waste anything is, it becomes painful when we see everything as our own nature, as our own self, than to carelessly waste paper or water or and certainly food is painful. You know, when I see this, "Do not use unwisely even a piece of paper," I think of our practice of when we used to have, before we got these smaller napkins, paper napkins that we use, we had more regular size napkins, and we would always cut them in half because they were just way more than necessary. And some people found this odd and rather off-putting to have half a napkin. But consider this, when I was in Japan, there were no napkins. You just had to be careful in how you ate. This is why we have some of these sesshin guidelines, or which are really just guidelines of Zen training, which is when showering, after you've wet yourself, turn off the shower while you're soaping and then turn it back on. But even with the hands, you see most people in public restrooms, like in airports, they flick that handle and they got water gushing out unnecessarily. If you needed it, sure, don't need to hold back, but when you're just when you're doing nothing but soaping your hands, and that, you know, for people who have heard the guidelines, that in cold and flu season, that means about, I think I've read 14 seconds, then why have the water gushing out all that time while you're not using it? It's easy enough. The handle's right there. Just turn it off, turn it back on. The real waste, the ultimate waste, even more than food, though, is wasting time. He goes on, be constantly austere with the body and do not do things for the sake of the body. The enemy of Dharma and Buddha is the body. Now this is, I think we read, when we were reading of the little biographical material we had in Bunan, reading that this is a particular, a characteristic of his teaching, this emphasis on not giving way to physical cravings and not pampering the body. This is a razor's edge. This is a fine balance that we have to find with this. We need to, of course, respect the body as the vehicle for awakening. It's a vehicle for practice at the very least, and treat it with a respect, with diet and exercise and so forth, but not become obsessed with it. We touched on this yesterday in Taisho. Talked a little bit about vanity yesterday. And I want to make clear that it's not that there's anything wrong with vanity. That's more a kind of a view of the Abrahamic religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, that there's this, somehow you're bad if you're vain. Buddhism doesn't need those labels of bad or wrong. It's much more practical. If we are vain, if we spend too much time worrying about our appearance, that leads to suffering. It's an attachment. We become, when we are attached, we set ourselves up for pain. You don't have to get morality into it at all. This is what I love about the Dharma. Leave morality out of it. It's just causation. If we devote too much of our time to our appearance, then we will inevitably become attached to our appearance, and then we are really setting ourselves up, because our appearance will change. And when it does, then we suffer from that attachment. And the same with everything else with the body. It's not that the body is bad. That's kind of lower level kind of old religiosity. Body's not bad. The body has its needs that we have to respect. We have to get beyond the whole notion of good or bad. See the body as like everything else. It's empty. It has no enduring substance to it. It's energy. Energy that is congealed in a certain form, that has a certain longevity to it, will then change. Even as it's changing now, this body. There's a statement in the Vimalakirti Sutra. The Vimalakirti Sutra is one of the sutras most esteemed in the Zen school. It reads like this: "This body is like floating clouds that change and pass away in a moment." Floating clouds that change and pass away in a moment. Our senses, our human senses of sight and feeling and so forth, are not acute enough for us to notice how the body is right now changing, that the body is right now in flux, that the cells of our body are in flux, being born, passing away, being reborn, passing away. This body is shimmering with energy and flux. We can't perceive that with our senses. Our senses are great for covering kind of a middle range of things, but they can't do the work of a microscope, and they can't do the work of a telescope. They do the work that we need mostly to function in this world, but they can't confirm for us the nature of physical phenomena, that there is nothing there fundamentally. And so we are so easily become attached to what we think of as the body, as something substantial and unchanging. When he says the enemy of Dharma and Buddha is the body, of course he means that our attachment to the body becomes a hindrance, an impediment to seeing the true nature of things, the true nature of the body and everything else. This is kind of a random mixture of things. The next one he says, look upon accepting things from others as like poison. Accepting things from others is like poison. This he may be speaking particularly to his monks, warning monks not to be ingratiating themselves to the patrons, the donors, or currying favor just to be given things. But then he goes on, when you have completely realized the great way, then you should accept those things which people hold dear. This is because it helps those people. So he's saying that when you've transcended egoistic attachment, when you've seen through the self and are free of greed, then sure, accept accept gifts because it helps those people. How does it help those people? How does it help us to enable people to give? Because giving is a wonderful thing. Giving elevates us. The practice of dana, that's the word for giving or generosity, is one of the key practices in spirituality. Charity. It's a way of practicing what we're doing while we're sitting. When we're sitting, the main practice is giving. Giving up our thoughts, relinquishing our thoughts, giving ourselves fully to the breath practice, the koan practice, whatever it is. That is the essence of Zen practice, is giving. Giving up, letting go. Our tendency is to clutch at things that are important to us. And for most people, that means their thoughts. It's to hold on. But this very holding on becomes our undoing. This capacity to give, to relinquish, to give up, is like a muscle that can be worked, can be developed, just like self-discipline is a muscle, a mental muscle that we can develop. We get used to letting go. We find that there are few, if any, times where letting go really is a problem. Giving up, giving to others. Some of us have a harder time than this than others. We're, because of our conditioning, we tend to want to hold on to things. We fear letting go of things. But the very practice of letting go of thoughts moment by moment and giving our attention to the practice, makes us relax a little about letting go, opening our hand, opening the hand of thought, as one Zen teacher put it. We're changing our conditioning every time we give ourselves completely, our mind, our attention to the practice. On another level entirely, on the level of just cause and effect, whenever we receive something that is sincerely given to someone, we're also helping the person acquire what in Buddhism is called merit. There are people, probably most of us know such people, who don't want to let you give things. They don't want you to ever pay the bill at a restaurant. Who always want to be the ones who are dishing out the favors or laying out the money. And the test with such people is whether they can also receive. If they're compulsive about always being the one paying the bills, then we have to suspect that it's not true giving. There's something else going on there, some kind of selfishness in their giving. I've been at a table at a restaurant where I wanted to even things up. The person I had paid several times before insisted on paying, and I finally felt I just wouldn't yield. I would just not allow this thing to get so out of whack, and the person got angry. That's a sign, isn't it? That's anger is always a sign of some kind of holding on, some attachment. There can be no giving unless there's receiving. There's a time to give, there's a time to receive, gratefully receive. To the Chinese, this matter of merit is much more prominent in their behavior. From what I've read, this is a great concern of lay Buddhists in Asia, is wanting to build up merit by giving donations, building temples, and things like that. When there's this famous encounter between Bodhidharma, or the founder of Zen, between Bodhidharma and the emperor, where the emperor had for years built monasteries and supported monks to probably what would be millions of dollars in today's dollars. And in this encounter with Bodhidharma, he wanted confirmation that he had sowed a lot of good karma and that he could expect to be to get quite a favorable rebirth. And he said, what merit is there in all of this, building monasteries, supporting monks, and so forth? And Bodhidharma said, no merit whatsoever. Some people hear that and they then get attached to that no merit. Just as they might chant the Prajnaparamita and hear this, nor is there pain or cause of pain or cease in pain, or no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, and misunderstand that. It's one side. One way to understand it, that there's no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind in the ultimate sense that is unchanging, static. There's no merit, and yes, there's merit. Of course, everything we do is the cause of a subsequent effect. Moment by moment, the way we're acting, the way we're speaking, the way we're thinking or not thinking is having, there are effects, there are consequences. The consequences that are favorable, are helpful, we call the causes of that merit. That's sowing merit. Goes on to another unrelated thing. During the period of practice and effort, should you be beaten and trampled by others, you should rejoice that the effects of the deeds you yourself produced in the past are being exhausted. So what in the world is he talking about during practice, being beaten and trampled by others? It's hard to know what he means by that. These monasteries could be rough, rough places. A lot of the monks were there for any reason other than spiritual. It could be a place to evade the draft. It could be a place where they were dropped off when they were toddlers, because these Chinese monasteries could be orphanages. So these were not all saints. Probably few of them were saints. And, you know, you get a bunch of guys together and living together and doing everything together, then there's going to be friction, and there can be, they can take it out on one another. But he's saying that whatever kind of adversity that we encounter is a way of expiating negative karma that we have sown. If we can avoid just lapsing into the usual kind of blame and revenge, then it really is an opportunity to work through. It's a settling of accounts within ourselves. It doesn't mean masochism, just putting up with things that are abusive. No, not by any means. But it means if we do suffer some kind of mistreatment, that we can, even as we try to redress the problem, we can also have some faith that it's not just random kind of happening. When Master Joshua was asked if a dog has enlightened nature or not, he said, "Moo." If you can really understand this moo, you will surely be free from doubts about anything in or out of this world. For example, when you first enter, you shatter being and nothingness. Just a comment on this. When you first enter, this is a phrase for... sometimes it's called entering the first gate, where you have some glimpse of your true nature, the nature of mu, the nature of reality. When you first enter, you shatter being and nothingness. You see beyond these categories, these dualistic ideas of being and non-being. These are such abstract words. Yesterday I made a stab at suggesting how the terms affirmation and negation could be understood in a more practical daily life way. Talked about when to yield and when to stand firm, when to say yes, when to say no. Being and nothingness, another way to understand that would be more, I think that people can relate to more, is that generally speaking, you can say that there are two different kinds of people. The people who are attached to being and those who are attached to non-being. And by that I mean it's kind of two different kinds of ego. The one kind is what in our popular kind of terminology we think of someone with a strong ego as someone who has is arrogant, someone who wants to be something. But then the other kind is the person who wants to go the other way, who wants to disappear, who wants to shrink or deny the self. It's two different kinds of attachment. One is attachment to the self. Well, they're both attachment to the self, but one is the more obvious kind of wanting to be better than others and wanting to inflate oneself, and the other is attachment to denying the fact of we do have a self. We are distinct, each in our own way. We each have our own individual personality and temperament and character and so forth. Drugs is a way that people will sometimes resort to escape the self. Of course, a very pain-producing way of trying to get out from under the pain of this ego, this self. Well, that's one of many ways you could distinguish between, many ways you could can understand this very common Buddhist dichotomy of being and non-being, or existence and non-existence. But then he goes on, having shattered being and nothingness, if you nurture it energetically, you break through the body. Having broken through the body, if you work hard, you break through the mind. Having broken through body and mind, the original mind appears. When you reach that, then there is no doubt about what the world-honored Buddha taught. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.